It's Cinco de Mayo, 2016, and it's... Thank you, John.
Arriba.
Arriba, yes.
Culturally insensitive. I'm sorry, I will not this... No, I will not partake. Also, I don't really know what it is, because it's not really a thing in Canada, but... Carry on.
It's episode... Well, you know what is a thing in Canada? Episode 475 of Radio Free Nintendo.
Eh, barely.
The day after, the day the music, after something, I don't know. Whatever. We're not. We're not going to talk.
Wasn't that an Emmerich film with the joke?
we're not going to get caught up in the bad times anymore until the next segment, of course, where you all wrote about the bad times. So we'll get caught up with that later. But first, it's time for new business. And John, you weren't here last week, and you've got some new business.
Yeah, God forbid it's a Wii U game. Wow. Doesn't happen often, so don't get used to it. Don't start getting any ideas.
Don't worry, they won't, because they won't have any to get used to us talking about.
It's sad but true. So I decided to download Lost Reavers from the eShop by Bandai
it's
Namco.
It's free, right? I mean, why the hell not?
It is free. Why the hell not? I have nothing to lose but time I will never get back. So
you like this game.
So, Lost Reavers, alright, so this was kind of sold, when this was announced a while back, it was kind of sold as like a treasure hunting game, right? And, I mean, really, it's more like it's a first-person shooter, with up to four players. And it's all online. I mean, yeah, you can actually play offline, solo, but why you would want to do that, I have no idea. It's easy, to get online, all you do is you just, like, create a room and then people can just hop in. So it's a first-person shooter, and the gist of it is that you and, you know, up to three of your best friends get dropped into these areas that are just kind of, I guess they're randomly, generated sets of rooms, and you go through blasting zombies and solving very simple puzzles along the way, and you eventually get to the treasure, which is just this object that you have to pick up and take back to the spawn point. There is some sort of paper thin story wrapped around all this, but it's just kind of like, the year is 2075 and mankind was out of, you know, resources on the planet, and they found out how to go back in time and get these, you know, treasures.
It was sounding a hell of a lot like The Running Man until the time travel bit came in.
Yeah. And it really doesn't have anything to do with gameplay, really. I mean, there's not you have four different characters to choose from. One is like a burly black guy that carries around, like, you know, rockets and, you know, a shotgun and has a whole bunch of guns and stuff. And then there's another guy who's, I think he has like a, kind of an axe and a sword, and he wears a mask, and he's just kind of the spooky one. And then there's a couple of girls that are like your typical sort of, you know, anime, you know, kind of jumping around with swords, kind of swinging hi-ya kind of stuff.
Swinging hi-ya kind of stuff coming to you live.
Yep.
From your Wii U.
Yeah. So it's just a lot of it. You can tell that this game was made with the intent of just making something very generic. A lot of the art assets look very generic. Everything is generally looks a lot the same all the way through.
Would you say it looks generic in the way that like Japanese developer trying to appeal to an American audience?
More like reused art assets, and just everything is very simple. So it's like you're going through a pyramid. Everything is just like blank walls or, you know, metal walls, like metal hallways, stone hallways.
Slightly tan bricks.
Lots of hallways, a couple of plants here and there.
Plants that grow inside pyramids.
Yep. Lots of crates to shoot. A lot of stuff like that where you just, you know, a lot of the rooms, just everything looks the same. Everything is very samey. And
I do want to ask you a question though, real quick before you go on.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying the moral of this game is that don't worry about your problems. Just go steal from your ancestors.
I guess. Yeah. They don't really go too deep into the lore of
ethos when we discuss how samey this game is. I'm just thinking.
I think the treasures are actually some sort of alien artifact. It's not important. Oh. I mean, the whole story, it scrolls by in a page at the start of the game.
I was just thinking maybe all of this reuse is a symptom of the same mentality as the game.
Potentially. But, I mean, that's probably giving it more credit than it actually deserves, because that would require some cleverness. But of course, it's free to play. So the question is, hey, they didn't make this game for nothing, so how are they going to make money off of it? So the hook is, of course, there's two types of currency. There are computer chips that decode weapon containers, and that is how you get new guns. So what happens is I played my character up to level 10. So after you weave through these different rooms, shoot all the zombies and solve all the puzzles, which are very basic, such as stand in this spot and hold down A, and, or walk over to this orb and shoot it until it explodes. Stuff like that.
Oh, somebody played Link Between Worlds.
Yep. Once you get the treasure.
Oh, damn, Major.
Once you get the treasure and take it back to the spawn point and your mission is over, that's when you get your points tallied up. And there's like some other kind of treasures like coins and stuff like that you can pick up and kind of cash in at the end. But overall, the more of these that you grind through, it's a very grindy game. You can get the one type of currency, which is free, and that lets you decode these weapon containers. And to give you an example of how long it takes to decode one of these, usually one of these chips, let's say there's one of these containers is worth 50 chips. Well, one of them is actually 2 chip points. So you would have to grind 25 of these to actually open up the new gun. So that kind of gives you an idea. And they don't drop that frequently, so you have to grind a lot to actually get any amount of these. I don't think I had any more than, I mean, I played for a couple of hours at least, and I probably didn't get, I mean, I probably played through levels maybe like 5 or 6 times, and I didn't get any more than maybe 10 or 15 of them. So you have to grind quite a bit to get these things. Or you can go on the eShop and you can spend cold hard cash to do that. So that's the hook. That's the free-to-play hook.
So let me ask a question then.
Sure.
Did you ever unlock one of these guns?
No.
Okay.
I was trying to unlock a rocket launcher, and I think I got up to about, it required 50 kind of chips to unlock, and I got up to like 16, I think, or something like that. So, yeah.
Like, I was wondering if they'd pull out the first one's free hook, so it's like, wow, getting a new gun feels great.
No, I mean, you get a default set of guns, and I think right off the bat, you kind of get one special gun. I don't know if it's like kind of randomly assigned to your character, but that's kind of the hook. They're like, hey, by the way, you got like kind of a loot box sort of thing, so go into your menu and check that and open it up and see what gun you got, and that's how they kind of like, kind of seed your lust.
Gotcha.
For new guns. And I mean, there's other things you can do. Like once you get to level 10, it unlocks, like you can decrypt these new guns, but you can also upgrade the ones you already have. And as you gain XP, you get skill points. And so you can add them, upgrade the accuracy of your gun. There's 4 different categories. You can upgrade them all, assign skill points as you see fit. For all of your guns, for like, your shotguns, pistols, whatever. So you can do all that. There's that kind of thing too. And then once you get to level 10, it unlocks a separate set. The first missions that you get from level 1 to level 10, very basic, just like, pretty much go through these 4 rooms, grab the treasure, and get all the way back. But I think that later missions, like there's tiers. So, there's certain missions I read that you can only open them at level 15. So stuff like that, and I think there are some that are actually like they're boss fights. I didn't get that far, but I think there was a couple of rooms that people had open that said defeat the boss. Like that was because you can kind of put like what the theme of the room, what you're doing, so you can have like open for everyone or defeat the boss or whatever. There's a whole bunch of different kind of settings that to kind of sort of like Monster Hunter where you can kind of create a room and then you kind of advertise what that room is for, like why what you're doing. So, yeah, so that's
Calico fans only.
it's just kind of grindy like that. And, it gets tiring because it's just kind of, it's very obvious. I mean, one of the themes that you can have for your room is literally the word grinding. So, like, it's like, oh, they're very open about it. They're like, yes, you will have to grind in this game.
I mean, it is a loot cycle game ultimately, right?
It is. Mm. Yep, that's exactly what it is.
I mean, at that point, you may as well just wear it on your sleeve.
Yeah. And I mean, in terms of how the game performs, there's the right off the bat, I had to adjust the camera because it's a first-person shooter, right? So it's very how the game plays is hinged a lot on how responsive the camera is and, you know, the controls and stuff like that. And the controls are nothing out of the ordinary, but for some reason, they have the camera setting, which is on a responsiveness scale of 1 to 15. They have it set at 4. So right out of the gate, I was sitting there and I'm like, why the hell am I turning so slow? It's so annoying. So, and I don't think it saves that either. So every time you start the game up, you have to adjust the camera setting. Because I went back in there. Now, granted, I quit via the gamepad. Like, you know, I just like closed out of the game. So maybe it didn't save it, but it should.
Yeah.
And I had to go back in and I'm like, oh my God, the camera's slow again. So I had to go in there, crank it up to 13 and keep going from there. So yeah. But yeah, and there's a lot of things in it where you can tell it's just, it was kind of hastily designed from the standpoint of people being able to troll because, at the spawn point, when you leave, there's two, kind of, I guess, as like kind of a last sort of hurdle to overcome. There's always two spawn points that monsters spawn out of. And there's nothing preventing somebody. So say the three of you, you know, you have the treasure, the three of you are on the kind of goal at the back at the spawn point, standing on the pad, and you have to stand on there for like five seconds and it counts down and then you complete the mission. There's nothing stopping one guy from sitting there and just standing there and just holding up the entire party.
Well, and first you had my interest, but now you have my attention.
So it's pretty troll worthy. And I couldn't find anything because what would happen is I think people, I don't think you actually get anything from killing the zombies. It's all about the treasure that you collect, right? Like it's not like you sit there and gain experience from killing the zombies. I don't think you do. Because I certainly didn't get any more experience than I did from one, you know, stage to the other when I was killing a whole bunch of zombies versus not killing any. But I think people kind of assume that. So they just sit there trying to like grind the zombies as they keep coming out of the spawn points. But all that does is just prolong the mission pointlessly. So I was just kind of like, oh man, dude, please just let me get to the next, just let me exit this because it's always, and you can't kick people out of your party, I don't think either. So it's just stuff like that. It's just pretty hastily designed, I think.
So the actual combat, though, and the going through the dungeons and stuff, I know it's simple.
Yep.
And there's a sameness to it. But does it at least have a decent feel? Like the feel of the weapons, you know, destroying stuff, moving through the level, like does it feel okay?
No, it's pretty clunky. For example, when you fire rockets, there's a little bit of a delay. It doesn't feel crisp. Like, you know, like first person shooters, if you play them on PS4, like, you know, or play them on Xbox One or like any PC, they feel crisp, right? Like, you know, but here the controls are pretty clunky. The camera is responsive, but it's still kind of hard to aim. They have an auto aim. So like your shotgun, like say if you have a shotgun, you'll just, you know, you hit the auto aim button. And it'll just lock on to like the center of a zombie and you just shoot, right? Now you can also get headshots, which is what I wound up doing. I kind of figured that I use the pistol a lot instead of, you know, a lot of my heavier guns, because with the pistol, you can just kind of line them up and headshot them and just one shot all the zombies. If you get them along the same, if you get their heads along the same horizontal line, you can just pop them off, right? But yeah, just kind of clunky and, you also sometimes when you're solving some of the puzzles, you'll see like the camera pans out and it shows like you from the back and you'll see a zombie kind of come up to you from behind, right? Cause they just like, you know, they spawn from the spawn points that are in most of the rooms and they lumber towards you and then they kind of give you like, if they catch you, they give you what I call the hug of death. Where it like literally looks like the zombie is like really not harming you. They're actually giving you a big hug and your health is going down. So it's kind of anticlimactic.
Good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Come here, give me a hug.
So maybe John, maybe that's not your health. That's your loneliness. And the zombie is taking you alone.
I think you're making this game a lot more meta than it was actually intended to be.
This game is about traveling to the past to meet your dead ancestors. Mm-hmm. And erasing the loneliness that comes in a world that has lost all hope and all resource, and then depriving those same ancestors of the opportunity to succeed by stealing what belongs to them. Unless your lonely heart is healed, at which point you leave the things behind.
So are you saying that the treasure is actually your heart? Maybe your broken heart? Maybe we're all just trying to get back to our spawn point, James.
I would say taking the treasure in the pyramid and taking it back to the future is actually the losing state. Because really, are you a better person for it? Or have you just deprived your ancestors of the opportunity to succeed? And ultimately, as their descendant, deprived yourself.
I guess sometimes you have to go back to the past to destroy it, James.
Sometimes you have to go back to the past to find your own future, John.
I think on that note, I think we're done with Lost Reavers.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you want a mediocre first-person shooter, yeah. That's really generic and grindy. Yeah, Lost Reavers is totally your
exactly
bag.
Exactly what I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
So, John, are you saying our long-planned, like, be on Lost Reavers video and just be assholes is either A, perfect, or B, a terrible idea?
It's both.
Great. That's really the best case scenario, isn't it? It's a terrible idea that's perfect. All right, so I'm going to go next. I never feel like I'm going to get to give Bravely Second like the window I wanted to give it, but just because of other stuff going on. But I will say that it's true to the series tradition. The game is longer than I expected it to be.
Mm-hmm.
It pulled its nice little swerve on me, and I sat there and stared at it, going, "Are you fucking with me again, game?"
Is it spinning its wheels or a little bit?
It's not doing the bullshit that the first game did.
Okay.
It just does enough to remind you of the bullshit, and you go, "Oh no, not again! No, not." Did everyone lie to me about this happening again? But it's not. It feels good. Like that game feels good, which is kind of a weird thing to say about the game. And I knew it felt good when I went into a dungeon. And the Bravely games, they kind of give you this nice little helpful guide at the top right of the screen, telling you like what level you should be for this dungeon. It's just like a five or six level range, like 40 to 50, and none of them that high, like 30 to 36. And I wandered into a side dungeon and I was six levels higher than the ceiling. And I went, oh, I've been dicking around in this game way too much. And granted, you would think that being that much stronger, you could just astroturf the dungeon. But the reality of the situation is like, the game still has a good enough feel that while yes, the enemies aren't menacing, I can't just, you know, brave four times and just roll them by hitting the attack button. Like I have to still put some degree of thought into how I'm going to handle them.
Yeah, usually and there'll be just some kind of composition of the enemies, yeah, some kind of grouping
right.
That means that, yeah, brute forcing it is not quite an option, mate. But you could probably come up with an auto-battle type of deal that takes into account the composition of the enemies and then deploy that once you kind of get the sense of what's going on there. But yeah, I mean, I use those bands to stay on pretty much the right pace all the way through, and all the dungeons felt pretty satisfying in that way.
And even being that many levels above, like I still feel like I'm having a good time with it. So I went and beat one of the protagonists, kind of rivals in the game, and I was five levels too high, like just a silly number of levels too high when you're thinking about a game that, like, at that point you should be in the 40s. I'm five levels too high over that. Like, that's probably an issue. And even then, like, yeah, the battle was probably a lot faster than, say, when you fought it, Greg. Like, I probably cleared it in less turns. But it still felt good. Like, I still had to really strategize around this person's particulars.
Yeah, like, there's the skills I like the strategy element that you've got there usually, you know, about. Obviously, it will depend on the job configurations of your own party to some extent. But, you know, a lot of the time the bosses have some kind of way that they might use particular kinds of attacks, or the way that they choose when they choose to brave or default and things like that. That gives you stuff to think about that isn't just about the numbers.
Right. And I will say, I want to speak about the classes a little bit, because when I really had time to talk about this game 2 weeks ago, I hadn't really gotten there yet. And last week, I didn't have time to talk about it. I am not a huge fan of the classes that came up in this game that are, you know, that are Bravely Second exclusive.
The new ones.
Because a lot of them feel like they were trying to remix, you know, pretty bog standard classes of Bravely Default. Because Bravely Default's classes are mostly inherited from Final Fantasy. Bravely Second's like trying to create like weird spins on them. So the Bishop class, which is essentially the White Mage analog, doesn't have some of the base stuff that the White Mage can do with like Shell and Barrier. And you have the opportunity to get the White Mage, but you get, essentially you meet two of the Asterisk holders from the previous game as side missions, and basically they're having some kind of idiotic argument about something. And usually one of them is being cartoonishly evil, and the other one is being, like, moderately evil. And you kind of have to pick one or the other, and this is where I thought this game sometimes reads like fan fiction, because it's like, hey, everybody, isn't Idia great? Let's have Idia decide everything in the world. And you're like, oh, yeah, this is kind of weird. But I had to choose between two classes I really wanted with the White Mage. And I said, well, it was the White Mage and the Time Mage. Or no, it was White Mage and the Merchant.
Merchant, yeah.
And I was like, well, I guess I'll go with the Merchant, because he's not being cartoonishly, or he is being cartoonishly evil, and I want both of them, so that's my deciding factor. And, you know, it's not a big deal that I can't get the White Mage, it's just, the White Mage just felt better for me than the Bishop, and that comes with like the I can't remember what the Black Mage equivalent is called.
Is it you thinking of the Wizard class, or is kind of
the one that can do spellcrafting.
The spellcraft one lets you kind of convert spells into different effects and stuff. I mean, I really like the Wizard class. That's a cool one. I kind of kept using that all the way through, just because the way you could convert magic attacks into physical damage is very useful. You've got elemental configuration and you've got the magic/physical configuration to exploit.
Yeah, I do. I just don't necessarily like the spells that it has, like the base spells, as much. I would love to take the Black Mage spells and throw them on top of the Wizard's skills. And I did, because I went and got the Black Mage, and I max job leveled both of them. And that turns into some kind of horrible death monster. But, but like having, you know, just some of the classes that of the add-on game don't feel as tight. And like the class, like there was very delineated, like, if you want to do this, these are the classes that work well together. I'm having a little bit harder time finding that in the sequel. And, you know, I know you can kind of collect the job classes from the other one, at which point you have far too many job classes to ever do anything with.
Although it doesn't take long to level them up once you've got certain things working in your favor, especially the chaining of experience where you could kind of, you know, get that multiplier working with battles in succession in really experience-rich environments. It wouldn't take you long to at least get through you know, because it's kind of geometric, the job point progression for the different skills. So you'll see a lot of them very quickly if you want.
The other thing that makes a big difference is that, unlike Bravely Default, in Bravely Second, there's not a stat penalty if you drop to a class you're lower level on, because job class also boosted the job specific stats in Bravely Default. So as you leveled up the job, like if you were the black mage, your magic based skills would all go up. Now there's no stat bonus or penalty driven by class. I mean, there is a base one, you know, but there's no, like, it doesn't scale based on the job level.
It's about unlocking the skills. So that's what the building up the job's about, which, you know, they can be very useful. And then there's some which you can then sort of equip, even if you're not using that class at all anymore. So you could get some kind of interesting combinations of like, well, what particular class you are, then, you know, what other class could you want to use the moves from, kind of the particular spells from, for instance. And then on top of that, you might have skills from a third or fourth class, or so you could get this, some really interesting mixes that prove fruitful.
Yeah, because I believe spellcrafting is actually a skill, not
yes,
a...
Yes, yeah, if you level up the wizard class, you can then just equip spellcraft to use it without being a wizard at all. Yeah, that's right.
Right, or even in your second class wizard.
Yeah, or even, nice. Yeah, the secondary, it's just a skill at that point, yeah, so you wouldn't have to have it as part of your kind of repertoire at all. And yet, that is pretty damn useful to be able to take some of these other spells that you get from other classes and you have that flexibility that the spellcraft affords to them.
Yeah. So I'm getting to the end for realsies of the game now. And it just feels like a very solid package of a game. And that's really all I could ask for here. We've made it through to the other side of the main JRPG storm. There's some other stuff down the way a bit, but you know, it was only
a couple of Dragon Quest games and you know,
don't forget, I haven't even got break. Fire Emblem yet. So
I thought it came out already.
No, it's in May, but it's not for another couple of weeks. So hold on to your butts.
Oh, that's right. I thought it was early May, not late May.
It's late. Yeah.
Oh man, so the storm still rages in Europe.
Yep.
Of course, we have the stuff coming in July and August. That is some of that's not Nintendo published, like Seventh Dragon. But like the storm still rages in all of our hearts right now. But what I really want to talk about is Star Fox Zero. And
I guess this is going to be kind of tag team new business, because that's mostly what I've been playing
I'm going to be the dissenter here. And I accept that. I think this game is going to be divisive, and I think ultimately what you want.
I don't know what
Fox
could possibly have given you that idea,
right? Yeah, I'm not sure.
What I believe is ultimately what you want out of a Star Fox game is going to dramatically impact what side of this divide you end up on.
Oh, you wanted a new story because you're deep in the Star Fox lore. And this reboot is not doing it for you.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I am kind of amused every time they just straight up took lines from Star Fox 64. Like, fuck it, just use the same lines. I don't care. It's like, why did you even bother re-recording the audio at this point?
They re-recorded the audio for 3D, right? They re-recorded Star Fox 64 because obviously the sampling quality was really limited on N64 because of the limited storage space. I guess they've done that kind of twice with some of these things.
Yeah, especially in the early mission. I think the very first mission, almost all of the dialogue for the first 3 minutes is exactly the same.
A lot of the beats are the same, you know, aren't they? You know, coming over the water, coming into Cornelia City, the robots pushing over the pillars and all that kind of, I mean, it's very similar, the first mission.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's a weird start to a game too, where you're like, what? Is this a remake? Did they just not tell us this is a remake? And then even with the waterfall boss, which is like the optional boss version of the N64 game, you're like, oh, this, what is this game? And ultimately you get an understanding that it's not a remake, but like there's definitely points where you're like, did you guys just run out of ideas? Is that why this game took 20 years? Was it just like, what do we do? Why don't we just I like Star Fox 64. Let's remake it. We already remade it. Oh, shit. Okay.
Well, I don't know. I think the fact that Star Fox having kind of made his web shooters instead of having them being organic makes quite a difference to the story. But that's just me.
Thanks.
I don't know.
Thanks, Peter. So what, to me, though, Star Fox is at its best when it's a roller coaster experience, when you are just slingshotting through a stage full of dynamic stuff happening all the time, flinging past you, enemies buzzing in, and you're just target shooting the crap out of them. And it's just constant just stuff happening. You are pushing forward. You have some degree of movement about it, but you're just driving towards the target. You get to the boss, and then you just, you turf the thing. Like that, to me, that's when Star Fox feels at its best. Star Fox Zero said, fuck all that shit. Let's get that out of here. How do you feel about all range mode? Do you like all range mode? Let's do some all range mode. Star Fox Zero does a shit ton of all range mode.
It's a lot of it, yeah. I mean, sure. To me, it was definitely the overall composition of the game. I could have gone for more of the straight up classic Star Fox type of levels, you know, the rails levels, because that is, you know, to me, what Star Fox is. And it should be the meat of Star Fox, any particular Star Fox game. But the counter I would also add to that is that I enjoyed, hinted at when I'd only played a bit of it, but now I've put about 20 hours into it at this point. The all range mode, I'm really surprised at how much I enjoyed that in this game, on the whole. Because it is much better than what it's been before. The controls are a big part of that. And some of these different scenarios, especially the dogfights with Starwolf, were really, really fun. I just was really quite surprised actually, because take something like Rogue Leader, you know, back on GameCube, which is, you know, a beautiful game. I'm a big Star Wars fan, you know, so I did really like that, but I never fell all the way in love with that because, you know, to a large extent, because it is, you know, an all range mode type game, you know, if you like. In some ways, I kind of would prefer if it had like some of the Star Foxy kind of shooting, sections, that are more narrow. But with this, it just, with the freeing up the controls, it just made those sections a lot more immediate and fun than I thought they would be. I still do lament the focus on that. I mean, I understand it that they, yeah, the impetus for this game, yeah, presumably was this use of the two screens and the controls and doing something they could do with the franchise that they hadn't done before. But, you know, I think they've got a bit preoccupied with that. And, you know, I took their eye off the ball a little bit, but I can't complain too much when I did enjoy, you know, what they came up with.
I'm going to posit a more nefarious reason. And I think there's a pretty easy case to make here, is that it's a lot easier to make an all range mode stage than it is to make a roller coaster stage.
Well, and also I would
a lot of territory.
And also I would add to that that it's probably makes the experience take longer as well.
Totally.
So I mean, for reason, because I mean, I think there's some questionable decision making in the way that the manner in which you're going to progress through the game the first time. It kind of leads you through all the levels that are going to take the most time.
Oh, they're the worst levels, too! It's just unbelievable!
It's just not the correct kind of pacing for a Star Fox game. If you go back to 64, you're going to hit one Landmaster level or the submarine level. That's it, right? You're not going to get multiple Landmaster levels. You're not going to get, you know, or you'll just get the one submarine level. Yeah, so it felt like they'd planned it out that way. And, you know, again, the amount of all range mode stuff was kind of rationed as well. And in fact, some of the sort of slowest, most ponderous stuff was reserved for the hardest route, the submarine level and set to Z. Right. Was kind of reserved for that. In this case, it's hitting you right up front, and I just think it would have been better if it was distributed, because ultimately, once you unlock the paths and you unlock the arcade mode, you could sit down and play from start to finish without even once getting in the Landmaster. So that's actually all the other way from Star Fox 64, because, you know, Star Fox 64, you had to get in one of those slower missions at least once. Here, if you're doing a run through, you could skip them if you don't want. But I just don't know why you'd front load it so much, other than to make it take longer to get to the credits, which seems like a bit of a base kind of motivator to me.
So you guys are saying that this game is being made worse for the same reason that Sonic games have not made it.
I think there's a good parallel there. I think there is, because, you know, with Sonic, there's often the feeling, it seems to me from the outside, having not played that many of those games, I should note, but it seems to me like they don't have quite enough confidence to say, let's just let the speed sections kind of, you know, speak for themselves, and that's actually what people want, and that's enough, even if it doesn't actually take very long to do. You know, there's always got to be something else there to kind of prop it up. You know, and that's what you've seen with Star Fox sequels. I mean, it's ironic in a way because the original Star Fox, it was Nintendo who pushed Argonaut into going on rails. Argonaut, you know, envisioned it more like Star Fox 2, you know, that was cancelled, or like X on the Game Boy, where it would be a fully kind of 3D, all-rangey kind of game. And Nintendo thought it would be better as a rail shooter. And then ever since then, they've kind of felt the need to keep introducing these things, you know, on foot and all this stuff to try and sort of, you know, add to the package. And yeah, and then, yeah, well, Command just goes way too far and just that is the game. Like, there isn't, I think apart from like the last boss, there is virtually no on rails kind of action to that game. And maybe fight, when you take down missiles that have been fired at the Great Fox or something. But I mean, no, so it's kind of interesting though that, you know, it is similar, I think, to the Sonic situation. However, what I would say is they're way more successful, in my opinion, with this stuff in this game than they've ever been before.
I firmly disagree. I think, so that first path, there's an R-Wing mission. There's an R-Wing mission turns into a Chicken Walker mission. Then there's the hover plane mission. There's another Chicken Walker mission. There's a Landmaster mission. And then you get back in the R-Wing. And every single one of those missions between the R-Wings are fucking terrible. For one reason. Tank controls. Tank controls are abysmal. They are a relic of the early 2000s
I really
and late
don't
90s.
Understand. One thing I don't understand is why everybody struggles so much with the walker controls. It seems really quite clear. I mean, even to the extent
I just
Guillaume
don't
talked about,
like it.
Even
like,
to
it
the
just
extent,
doesn't feel good.
No, you may well not like it. I'm not. That's not the point. I'm just saying, like, there's been a lot of talk, like Guillaume was talking about, sort of taking a while to get used to them, and I didn't experience that myself. I just, you know, I mean, it controls like a normal game, you know, third person game to a certain extent in that moving the camera stick, you know, moves the character.
Maybe we just tend to look at the wrong camera actually when we're playing as the walker. Like I could control it well when I was looking at the TV. I was looking at it in third person. It was fine. But as soon as I was trying to aim and to hit stuff with it, then that's when I started having trouble.
Because you lose any sense of perspective. And because the walker is moving through obstacles, like having perspective is super important because in part it's using tank controls. So you end up with this situation. It's not like, it doesn't feel like a first person shooter where your primary aiming is driven by one stick in terms of up and down, but everything else is driven by the other. All locomotion, including side to side movement, is driven by another stick. Because ultimately locomotion is still driven by one stick, your aiming is driven by the pad, and then like this other velocity control stick drives other stuff. It's actually more complicated than a first person shooter because there's now three control devices that are governing aiming and locomotion.
Yeah, and I mean, look, for me, it was pretty simple, kind of I know what you mean. I think some of the problem is trying to maintain continuity with the R-Wing controls that they've got there. So it's like, oh, well, you can still double tap the right stick to barrel roll. You can still press the forward the right stick to do the boost, and then you can hold back on it to do the hover and all that kind of stuff. But
I just
ultimately
don't understand why they had to make super dimensional Fortress Star Fox. Like, why does everything have to transform? Like, why the fuck does the tank turn into a plane? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, the tank with the plane thing, there's two things I got out of that. I mean, first, on the snow mission using it, I think I only ever used the hover mode to get out of the way of the boss when it's going to slam down on you. I really didn't use it at all otherwise. Because even the enemies that sort of flip their weak spot, you can just gain a little altitude and shoot or like drive up on the snowbank.
Or you can just arc your gun up in the rocket.
Yeah,
goes
yeah,
up
and the
comes
missile
kind of
comes down because yeah, they are missiles. It's not just like a laser. And then on Titania, I think it's more successful because if you're playing for score, the hover tank part actually lets you brake. You could slow down the vehicle, which with the tank you can't do so much. You know, you are traveling at a fixed rate, and then you can hover when you hold back on the stick. So that way it kind of, you know, lets you kind of slow down for certain bits of the level and take pot shots at stuff and, you know, playing for medal scores and all that kind of stuff. I kind of felt like it added to something there for replaying the level, but it's not a very important transformation as far as I'm concerned. And, you certainly could have done without it.
On the snow stage, they're basically constantly going, you should transform. And I'm like, no, it sucks. Like, it sucks.
Well, there's just no real need for it, though, either. There's just, you know, with the boss, you can just hover up in the air and take out the weak points from there. You don't have to go over the top of it.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to do it the way the game was telling me with the plane, and I couldn't do it. Like, I just couldn't, because basically, when you get over it, then the boss stands up and it knocks you backwards. And
yeah,
you
it's not safe anyway. I didn't feel like the game was pressing me so much to do that, but you know, you certainly don't want to. Like I said,
Pepe just hates you.
The whole sort of point of these all range modes to me is about establishing a kind of safe distance from an enemy, circling it, and then shooting into the circle. And that's exactly what you can do with the tank, and you don't have to bother with the hover thing, and apart from when it decides it's gonna, you know, slam you, and you just want to get out of the hell out of there. That's it. I mean, with the walker though, again, like I said, I mean, for me, it's interesting because I didn't find the same control problems that a lot of people did for whatever reason, you know, just like when, I guess, I don't know, the whole Z targeting type of deal kind of came pretty naturally to me in terms of just, you know, when you're moving freely, you're using the kind of, the right stick to move the camera around you like I would in a Zelda game or whatever that to change directions. But then once you lock onto something, then you're kind of doing that weird chicken walker version of the icky shuffle left and right to kind of sidestep enemies firing at you. So, you know, it just clicked pretty fast. I mean, I'm not huge on using the walker for extended periods of time, but the parts where you could just shift in and out of it, mainly to use it as a turret gun, really feels great. I mean, the Gigarilla boss, which, you know, the first time I fought it, it took me quite a while to kind of get you're trying to fire at the back of it to open up a weak spot. And, you know, I thought, well, I got to use the R-Wing to get around the back of him because you need the speed to get there before, you know, he's going to turn around or whatever. But then, of course, the problem with the R-Wing is you're still always moving. So as much as you can kind of slow down and fire into the circle, like I said, it still doesn't give you quite as much of a clear shot as you'd like. But then once you get to the point where it's like, okay, well, I'm just going to fly between its legs and then transform into the walker as soon as I do that, while locking on, so that the walker automatically does the 180 and snaps right at it, you could just blow him to shit in seconds. It is remarkably effective. Once you start to master just ducking in and out of it at the correct times, it feels very empowering, very smooth, and it feels like you're actually getting more skillful at the game. I mean, with a lot of games, you feel like you get better at them. You learn them, you know, the patterns, the type of design, whatever it may be. But because these controls are kind of new, there's a little extra element to it. You know, I just feel like you're getting more skillful at the very basics, the fundamentals of this game. You know, when to look to the other screen, or, you know, when to kind of transform into the walker or get out again. And that's something I really enjoyed about the last boss. I mean, there's a lot of grumbling about the last boss, and it took me a little while to kind of identify what it was doing, you know, what it was going for. But once I did, I really, really liked that. I thought it was great. It's easily one of the most interesting last boss. Well, it's the most interesting Star Fox last boss. I mean, the original one was cool to look at back in the day, but there's not a lot going on there. And then the brain thing in Star Fox 64
forgotten
tedious.
The last boss of Dinosaur Planet.
I have not forgotten it. I have just never played that game.
Oh, okay.
It is
inarguably the most interesting and befuddling Star Fox final boss. But see, I actually hate the final boss of this game, and I beat it on my second try, but I despise it because, again, it's like, hey, remember this walker that you kind of don't like? Fucking play a lot of it. And it's like, but The walker's not Star Fox. This isn't what I want from my Star Fox game. Just let me fucking fly the R-Wing. Like, why?
He can transform into the R-Wing inside his little cylinder.
Yeah, but so. you're at the other wall, and you've hit the wall, and now you're taking damage.
Well, again, it's surprisingly useful, though. There's a lot of times where you can get out of his attack, you know, when he's going to clap his hands on top of you, just transform into the R-Wing, zip across, do that 180 thing I talked about with the lock-on, you're back on target. And then towards the end, when he's doing the crazy eye beams all around and all that, at first I was trying to dodge with the walker, like with the hover and all that, but that's really slow. Just transform into the R-Wing. You could circle him again. It's a lot of the game is locking onto something and establishing a good flight path, a little sort of nice little orbit around it. And then it's really easy to just duck down under the beams at the appropriate times to stay healthy. Once I kind of got that I can use the R-Wing in here to a certain extent, and then really, you know, just pound him with the walker when I get the chance. It really clicked, and that to me was the fact that it kind of took a bit of reasoning out, and that it wasn't just a straightforward encounter, is way more interesting, I think, than a lot of Star Fox bosses, or just last bosses in general. Most of the time, they're a bit anticlimactic. But so, I mean, that was great. My main criticism, boss wise, is just that there are no orthodox bosses at all. They're
no,
all,
even
all
bosses that they straight up stole from both Star Fox games.
No,
like
and
the
I think
carrier.
That, yeah, the,
that carrier battle is fucking garbage.
I disagree. You can kill that very, very efficiently.
That's not the point, though. The point is, like, it doesn't feel. Here's a great point. The all range mode is missing one really important thing. What is it? Because it's kind of a big deal with that boss in particular. There's no radar on that in that game at all.
Yeah,
so
that's what the target view is for. It's to,
but that's only for one thing. When you can get target view on it, when you're fighting a bunch of things and there's lots of things like what the situation is like, kill 30 things.
That's where they have the warning audio for other. If you're concentrating on that and for some reason you can't see an enemy that's coming in near you, you do get a sort of an audio warning,
right?
So beep 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 beep. You know, the proximity warning that something's coming in. I didn't really have a problem with that, and I found actually not having to rely on the radar as I did with, you know, Star Fox 64 to be a lot better. I mean, it's more interesting to look at than, you know, a yellow triangle on a little box in the corner, but also it looks more interesting, sure, but the whole thing just felt more interesting. I really like the target view. I mean, at certain times, for instance, like fighting Star Wolf when they're in the their walker mode, which is the sort of bestial wolf thing, it's really cool when you're kind of locked on and you could see, oh, it's running behind me. Let me just work the brake. It'll then be running in front of me and I can blow the shit out of it in no time. That stuff like that is great. It's way better than just reading off the shitty radar to guess where things are.
Kind of drifting away from something.
Both? Because I find the target view to be not useful personally. I think it
would be acceptable to have both, certainly. I'm a little surprised they don't. But I'm far happier with it this way, but it's an interesting point. And also, it would have been a useful way, I think, to denote where the limits of the play field are. You know, it's going to force you to turn back in. I think that would have been perfectly acceptable to have, at least as an option. I agree there.
The Star Wolf fight, I didn't use the targeting mode at all for those fights, because I don't like that disconnect. I like to feel like I am not kind of this weird counter angle control of like, well, you're actually controlling from a side perspective. So, but even then, I don't need it. Like, I down the Star Wolf team in both encounters in sub 2 minutes. Like, it's just, they're useless. I mean, they are the least menacing version of Star Wolf to date, which is saying a lot. And
yeah, I don't know if it's that they're that menacing or anything. They weren't that menacing before. It was just fun to shoot them down. It wasn't fun
I guess.
Before.
Like I
that,
just
that,
I,
that was my feeling on it.
there's just so little of this game that gets at what I want. And the fact that none of the boss battles get at it is...
I think that's a big mistake.
It's insufferable.
At least you could have... Again, I find the all-range boss battles to be a lot more fun than I was expecting. But I think at least some kind of change of pace. Maybe you could have worked them in as mid-bosses or something, like your traditional kind of Star Fox battles, would have been, you know... to the game's benefit, because I just feel, you know, they could probably be, yes, they'd be shorter, but it could be more intense, and just gives you the chance to, you know, maybe put these controls to use, you know, in that sort of setting. I mean, I talked when 2 weeks ago about I wasn't sure what they were going to add to the traditional levels, but you know, obviously they don't add as much as they do to the all range mode. But having started to go for scores now, and I've got almost all the medals. In fact, I've got everything that is a score based thing. The only thing I'm lacking are these sort of more mysterious ones that you know I'll keep looking for them for a while longer, and then I might have to sort of consult with a guide. Because some of them must be pretty well hidden, considering how many have gone through the levels at this point. But when you're playing for score, I kind of feel like it opens up the, you know, what is so useful about these controls, even in the corridor levels, because the way you could just kind of, oh, that enemy's about to get away, and just snap your view 90 degrees, lock, shoot down, and then, you know, go back to what you were doing so smoothly. You know, it gives you incredible opportunities to open up bigger and bigger scores. I mean, if you see on YouTube what people are doing with the score system, it's wonderful. I don't think I'll ever get that good, but you know, it's taking everything from the Star Fox 64 score system, as you might imagine. So you know, again, you're getting bonus points for taking down multiple enemies at once.
Which also it goes against most shooters, because most shooters you only have one shot to get an enemy. That's it. And it's gone by you.
That's the thing. It's opening up that world of like, well, you know, you can kind of take things out in a different order in a way by looking at different times. And, you know, like I said, this whole kind of splat, Star Fox 64 really emphasized this idea of taking things out with splash damage. That was how you got the highest scores, was that if you actually didn't engage the lock on, you held both shoulder, but they held both wings level. The kind of negated the lock on, and so you just used a kind of manual charge shot to put an explosion somewhere that would take out a bunch of enemies. That was how you got the best scores in Star Fox. You probably wouldn't really need to master that to just get the medals in the original Star Fox 64, but if you wanted to get gold medals in Star Fox 64 3D, you was going to have to do that. Well, that comes back in this, where if you hold down the front left shoulder button, then you can again negate the lock on and start. But the difference is now that, kind of as James alluded to when he was talking with Johnny about why you want to play in cockpit mode, you can really, between the motion aiming and the fact that you've got cockpit mode as one of your screens, you can really, at least I can, before I always struggle to really precisely aim those shots because your ship's in the way. You know, and you're trying to hit a specific spot on the ground where it's going to catch the most ships out. So now you can do that really, really to a nicety, take out a whole bunch of enemies in that explosion, and then pinpoint their corpses as they fall into the ground and get extra bonus points for that. So it just, you know, the level to which, you know, you could probably really advance play and drive up the scores is fantastic. But there are no leaderboards. There are no leaderboards for score, which is insane to me. I mean, Sin and Punishment 2, which they knew would sell extraordinarily modest, you know, number of units, had online leaderboards for scores, and yet
Is Star Fox Zero. So, I mean, ultimately, it's...
Trust me, Sin and Punishment 2, you know, well, it was on a much more popular system, so there is that, but, I mean, I'm pretty
and
confident
again,
Star Fox Zero
to be fair, right now, Sin and Punishment 2 has as much leaderboards as Star Fox Zero does.
Yeah, because the Wi-Fi connection passed off this mortal coil, so we haven't got them anymore.
But at least they tried. Like,
they did. And I mean, I wouldn't even necessarily need hard leaderboards. If you just gave me the Pikmin 3 show where I am on the curve. That would be something.
Mm.
That would be like, okay, where am I relative to everyone else? And then, you know, I go back, I improve it. Okay, how much did I move? You know, did Smash Brothers GSP thing. Something. Anything to just give me any kind of idea of where I am against the whole player base. Yes, you can post them to Miiverse and all that kind of thing, but that's, you know, so limited. I cannot understand how you can have such a game, seems beautifully set up for Score Attack, and then not capitalize on that. That's crazy. But I suppose Star Fox 64 3D was just as guilty. It just wasn't as shocking when it was a relatively early 3DS game.
I'm glad you're enjoying this game. I don't see that I'm ever going to come around on it. I never really enjoyed All Range Mode, and a game that seems so heavily focused on it is just, you just fuck right off. But to me, the most disappointing thing is the use of the Landmaster. Like, the Landmaster has two really sublime missions in the N64 because you're down, everything's racing at you, everything's flying above you. Whereas in this game, it's battle tanks for the N64. Like, ultimately, it controls the same way. It's the same kind of challenges. It's like this game just is doing nothing for me on a regular basis. And, you know, maybe I can get better at it, but it's still not going to do anything for me. It's still not going to press any of the buttons I want it to press. And I think ultimately, like, they screwed up a lot of stuff. I think the lack of doing reels like, this is what Star Fox is gameplay, is to show off their control scheme, is kind of hubris. It's like, look, we've got this control scheme. It's really good. Here's not the game that you want, but look how good it works, this control scheme. It
well,
doesn't...
I just think it's a lack of confidence in the typical Star Fox format to hold people's interest for an entire game, you know, or to be
commercially viable. But Star Fox 64 does that and is regarded as a classic.
Yeah, like, but it also came out in 1997. I mean, standards were different then.
And I played it right after Star Fox Zero, and it's just, it doesn't hold up that well. Like, Playing it after Star Fox Zero, it just felt slow.
I had way more fun playing Star Fox 64 today than I did playing Star Fox Zero this weekend.
Yeah,
because it gave me what I wanted. Where Star Fox Zero says, "I know what you want. I'm going to tease you with it a little bit. All right, now get on the chicken walker and walk through this tiny hallway." It's like, no game.
It kind
this
of gave
what
me
I'm
what I
for.
Want. Like, what is this thing about? Like, oh, it doesn't give me what I want, so it's a failure. And like, I don't know. Like,
because
franchises...
it's a Star Fox series, man.
Yeah, but franchises should be given room to grow and to change.
Well, this one grew into a fucking shit pile. So there you go.
Nuanced as ever, James.
Let me just say, the chicken walker is not at any stage where it's like, hey, walk through this area. It, like those tiny tunnels, it's like, oh, I can't see where the hell I'm going. I have to go press a button and stand here and wait for the button to click, turn around and walk back out of the tunnel. Like, all of that stuff is just not. It's not good. Like, it doesn't need to be there.
Yeah, we knew the game was going to be divisive, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with not liking the game, but it does make you a garbage person.
No.
Another thing I would point out that was something of a disappointment to me was the fact that, not so, the whole story thing I could give two bits about, but the fact that you didn't have as many kind of new feeling locations is the real thing. You know, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Kid Icarus Uprising as a rail shooter. You know, I think, you know, design wise, playability wise, it's not nearly as good as Star Fox Zero in many respects, you know, with those levels and the gameplay and things, but it takes you on a crazy ride. You go interesting places.
Totally.
You know, there's the reset bomb and alien invasions and all that. You know, I mean, you see some crazy shit, and that's on 3DS. You know, the fact that they're just retreading Star Fox locations. Really?
But here's the thing, you could totally get that back. Like, you just said Kid Icarus could do it. Like,
no, yeah, but it's
killing the freaking eggplant wizard. You can do this.
Well,
but I mean,
it's in a different way, isn't it? It's not going to be purely like technical, like, wow, I'm seeing polygons.
Well, no,
or,
sure,
you know, like,
but Kid Icarus wasn't about that this time.
No, it's about, like I said, art direction, just, you know, these different set pieces and stuff, you know, like they felt like there was a hell of a lot going on there. You know, and there isn't nearly so much in that department in terms of fresh things to see and to experience and all that. It doesn't take you on, or even, you know, I would say compared to Sin and Punishment games, they take you on crazy psychedelic rides through madness.
Yeah, that's what I want.
This is not a fantasy game. It's a space game. And we know what space looks like thanks to Star Wars. It looks like desert, ice, jungle, and that's it.
I do want to find whoever is just stealing Star Wars sound effects for this game and just turn them into like copyright authorities. Because it's just like, did you just get The Force Awakens and just rip the audio from it? What are you doing?
You could say the same thing about Episode 7. It's like, oh, do we have to go to a desert planet and a snow planet
again?
And I did.
Like, oh, you
is that all
it
there is in the
Star
galaxy?
How creative, assholes!
No, I mean, there is a similarity there, but again, that's the, you know, it's just...
Why is there so many opportunities where it's like, okay, there are, you need to kill 30 enemies. It's almost always 32, which is weird. But there's no timer telling you how long you have. And if you miss, what's the effect of missing? Because it seems like the effect is you go on a different route, but in the immediate moment of the game, it doesn't necessarily tell you that.
Sometimes it's just a hit bonus, and which is, you know, important for getting medals, but otherwise not important.
Right.
But you never know which ones are which, and if... how long you've got to do
yeah,
them.
Yeah, I think there could be some more transparency about certain things. Like, you know, I mean, I'd just like to, because there's the medals, there's kind of different classes of medals almost. You know, you've got the ones you get from school, you get the ones
right.
for like the special requirements that give you the mission accomplished message at the end. You have ones for going through the three gold rings that have the little kind of medal attached to them. It would be nice to go back, now that I'm really down to the last few, and I've kind of forgotten exactly what I've done, it'd be nice to go back and say, oh, okay, well, I've got 4 out of 5 on this. Which 4 did I get again?
You know,
that would actually help me kind of narrow down what I should be doing on that level to get the 5th one. You know, things like that, I think I like the fact that they've kind of expanded the medal system to include other things, and there's some kind of secret stuff and all that. That's fine. But, you know, perhaps I'd just be a bit more upfront about some of these would make it more appealing for people to go back and get all of them. I certainly intend to go get all of them because I would very much like to unlock the black R-wing, which is the sort of one with the multiple lock-ons all the time. You get multiple lock-ons if you get the best laser, but you can lose that really fast. Like, you will not have...
Why do you lose that? Like, I can't figure out
you just get damage. You lose it. I mean,
it's not a wing damage thing. It's like any
There is no wing damage in this. And to be fair, I think that's a good decision because the old way of doing it was kind of Resident Evil. Evil-ish. It's like, oh, you've taken a hit. Let's ruin your mobility. That's going to help you out, right? You know, it just...
Keep your lasers between stages?
I actually like that better because I like the fact that... Yeah, because I like the fact now that it's not so much leveraged on, like, you know what? This stage is a complete piece of piss if you bring the maximum laser in from the last one. And then if you die once, somehow, by accident, whatever it might be, and you're starting it with the shitty laser, well, then you're in big trouble. It's like, well, no, we all know every level, you know where you're going to start, what you're going to start with. So the level is designed around that accordingly. I think that makes much more sense.
I think you hit it earlier. I think this is ultimately what it is. I don't feel like this game takes me on any kind of ride. It feels disjointed. It feels like they just like, look at all these toys we made. We want you to see all of them.
I think the toy element is. If it put, a lot of it is a toy element. You know, I think that like the gyro wing thing is very sort of a toy type of experience. So I kind of enjoyed that the first time. Going back and getting all the medals was not so much fun with it. But, you know, in general, I think there is a feeling of play with all these sort of gadgets and things. And I really enjoyed that. That's the thing. In the end, I got to a point where I just felt like it was letting me do really cool stuff that I hadn't done in Star Fox games before. All range mode was way more fun than it was before, and it all came together. And I think it is the most playable Star Fox yet. It's got a smoothness, you know, the fact that the frame rate is pretty solid. You've got the smooth frame rate, smooth controls. everything just feels good. The mechanics of the ship, the weight of it, and all that kind of maneuvering feels good. So all of that's there. I just wish, you know, they had a little bit more traditional Star Fox beef to go with it. You know, bosses, extra levels. You know, when you go to Sector Omega, which is kind of this weird melange of Star Fox 64 levels. There's a bit of the asteroid belt. There's a bit of Area 6. There's a bit of the surface of Venom from the easy side where it kind of splits into two and Slippy says, I'll take right. You know, like it's this really weird cocktail. And then the carrier boss from the first level at the end. but that is when you're going really fast and all that. Like, that is a cool level, and more of that to just kind of, you know, to be the meat of a game with the all range stuff and around it would really have pushed it over the top for me to be, you know, just a really top notch game.
And but I think that's why I hate that carrier boss so much. It was like, oh, you're finally going to give me the level that has what I want. Oh, but you're still going to make me fight this thing like this. It's like, for fuck's sake, game, just for once, let me fight a boss in a traditional Star Fox way, please. Like, this game will never, ever tick the right checkboxes for me, which is frustrating because we haven't had a really solid, like, really good Star Fox that does this kind of stuff since 1997.
Yeah, it's been a long time. For me, you know, you look at something like, there's big differences with Sin and Punishment and Star Fox, but you look at something like Sin and Punishment 2, I mean, it can be done. You can make a game that feels pretty beefy, but, you know, it is still like a straight shot arcade style experience that is mostly about kind of replay for scores if you're going to play it in the long run. You know, they did it. There's no all range in that. There's just this crazy range of bosses and all that. It's not like, you know, that's tapped out. I mean, they could have done more, but it's just, I think some of it is about, you know, the commercial stuff, you know, the fact that, you know, maybe they don't feel like a game, like I said, so, you know, a game like Sin and Punishment is never going to sell very well. Maybe they think this is their way of making it sell better, is if it's, you know, something that, you know, is more kind of open and has had more of that toy-like kind of play element to it. And the other thing I would say is just that, you know, there's certain franchises that Nintendo is willing to churn out another game without it being very different. Animal Crossing, Mario Kart, New Super Mario Brothers, you know, they're quite
Pokemon.
Happy to do. Yeah, they're Pokemon, you know, they're quite, where it's really, really successful, it's like, okay, we'll do it. In other cases, like F-Zero, we get this, well, basically, we can't think of anything, you know, different to do with it, so we're just not going to make one. You know,
mm-hmm.
But that's the attitude they have. That
well, I mean, if they could fuck it up by using the gamepad in a goofy way, I'm sure they would do it.
Well, this is the point. I mean, this is the point. I think Miyamoto, you know, it seems to be with certain franchises, like, it's just that's the only way you're going to get them to pick it back up again if they think they can put some sort of new spin on it. And, you know,
it's all top down from the gamepad.
Was that's the Nintendo Land thing, right?
Yeah.
But that's the thing. I mean, in this case, I think that was the impetus for us getting a Star Fox game again, finally.
Yeah.
You know, for the first time in 10 years. And so ultimately, you know, I'm glad it did because that gave us a new Star Fox game and I rather like it. But at the same time, it doesn't give me much hope that they will they'll come back round to the kind of Star Fox game that I'd probably like even a bit better again, sadly.
So let's talk about the only good Star Fox game since, say, Star Fox 64.
I think we'll Star just Fox... skip Star Fox God. I've barely
I've done a little bit with it, and I'm like, oh, this almost makes me not want to return everything. That's cool. So yeah, we'll pick it up. Guillaume,
yes.
What do you want to talk about?
I've been playing a few games that, like, I've accrued a backlog without really trying, just like Miitomo's making money without Nintendo really trying. I'm just like, I accumulate the free games. And so, so I've been playing Picross Twilight Princess, and I feel a lot better about picking that up than I did about WarioWare Touched. If you like Picross, then it's a sure thing. I mean, yeah, when Soren was here, and I think she talked about the game, she said that it was quite short, but I looked in my file, and I think I've been playing it for 10 hours. So, you know, of course, Serena's kind of a machine. She can multitask and she can, yep. you know, make games and you know, she makes you know, like she does spreadsheets for Shin Megami Tensei games to really like wring every little thing out of it. So yeah, I'm not at that point. I'm not that good. I'm not as good as her at Picross, but I'm, you know, I know what I'm doing. I've turned off all the assists. There's a lot of assists that are on by default that kind of allow you to cheat a little bit your way through the puzzles.
Are they themed assists like the Pokemon one?
Not that I've noticed. No, it's just.
Damn it! I wanted to turn into a wolf assist.
No, it's more like you know,
scent
like
trails assist.
Different wolf songs for different assists.
But you have to use the stylus to make the notes go up and down.
I think that Picross DS had something like that, where you could have kind of a random column and row kind of filled up for you. And so I think you can have that here. And also the whole mode where you have two modes, one where it doesn't tell you when you made a mistake, and one where you kind of lose time as soon as you make a mistake. And so I've made it so that I don't know when I make a mistake. Like I'm, that's the way that I prefer to play it. So sometimes that's led me to being like, wow, I can't figure out what I did wrong. And
yeah,
I have to start all over.
Yeah, so you're not going to find out the part of the chain where it went wrong. Well, you could, but it would be far quicker just to start over.
Yeah, yeah. So, but you know, so I'm playing, you know, Picross as I put the difficulty as high as it can be, and it's lasting me quite a while. So I finished the normal Picross puzzles. There's this thing called Mega Picross, which is something that Jupiter, the developer, introduced in their you know, their eShop downloadable games.
Picross E.
Picross E.
Whatever number, yeah.
Right, 1 to 7. So it's kind of just a different way to mark what boxes to fill up. You'll have certain numbers that apply to two rows at the same time. And, you know, like you have to pay attention the first time they explain to you the new rules, because it does, you know, mix things up a little bit, but eventually it's still essentially Picross, just with a slightly different set of rules. And it's pretty fun. And then there's something called Micross, which is just, you've got this big, like 8x8 grid, and each of these boxes are themselves a kind of a simple Picross puzzle. And I'm not too much of a fan of that. Like, eventually, I guess the idea is that you fill up this whole thing and you get a giant picture, but...
Yeah, they do that. The Pokemon Picross has a couple of legendary Pokemon that are made up of where you have to earn tiles by doing missions on the regular Pokemon puzzles.
Yeah, it's just not that interesting. Like, it's a cool idea in theory, but then you actually play it, and it just leads to a lot of uneven Picross puzzles. You know,
some of them are just like really, really like simple. There's hardly anything is ever going to get filled in, so you're just kind of putting X's all over the place. Like that. That's how it ends up in Pokemon Picross with that. But I guess it's more just like a. Almost like a kind of achievement tracker thing, you know, like getting those tiles is like an achievement in itself. So it's just kind of a way of visualizing your progress while doing a little bit of Picross as well, kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's the way it works in that anyway. I can imagine it's a bit different in Twilight Princess.
Yeah. And it just, you know, it's just a well-made game. And I like the, you know, like you've got the Twilight Princess overworld music, which is really not, by a long shot, the worst music that a Picross game has had. But I do turn it off. I do turn it off after a while.
Strong sales.
It gets a little bit annoying when you've been staring at a puzzle for 10 minutes.
Yeah, anything would when you're in that kind of scenario, definitely.
Yeah. But... And, you know, other than Minna in the tutorial and then, you know, like, spinner puzzles, or you know,
the Dominion Rod in
15. Or when you mark...
I'm just glad the Twilight Princess is finding work these days.
Yep. But yeah, and the when you mark squares, like you get the sound of Link cutting grass, so that's a nice touch. But there's not a whole lot of Zelda in this overall. But I'm enjoying it, and I thought that after Picross 3D, I was done with 2D Picross. But I'm really not. Like the game now, like I've got this as a download, right? And I thought back in the days of Picross DS that I played that game from beginning to the end without it leaving my DS, and I thought, well, maybe it's just because I'm lazy, right? Like I'm I don't want to switch games, and if I had this sitting residing on my system, I would just play a puzzle here and there, and between two games. But no. Once Picross gets its hooks into you, you just like I just can't stop
You're a
playing.
Weak man.
I think being digital is just going to make it worse. I mean, it's just because you know then you don't have to swap out the card to try something else for a little bit. I can't wait for Picross 3D 2 or whatever it's another round, whatever they're going to call it. It seems like it's
going
to
happen. Another round.
It seems like it's going to happen. It got rated by the German ratings board or whatever. They haven't announced it, but that digital is going to be fantastic.
I think you've had enough. I'll tell you when I've had enough. Another round, sir.
And the last game I want to talk about today is a game that everyone can download for free again. And, anyone who has an Amiibo, at least one, can play a little bit of. And it's Donkey Kong versus Mario. What's it called? Mario versus Donkey Kong and Friends? No.
Something
Mario
like
and
that,
Friends
yeah.
Amiibo Challenge. Anyway, it doesn't really matter.
We're professionals.
it is a Mario versus DK game.
It absolutely is.
And
yes.
Other one.
Yeah, but
Mini
it's
Mario
really well
and
made.
Friends Amiibo Challenge.
At this point, the developer NST knows how to make takes on lemmings, and it shows. You know, it's pretty good. I enjoy it. So I've got a few Mario theme Amiibos. There's 9 of them that you can use in this game. And if you get any Amiibo at all, even one that's not Mario theme, you get to play as some, you know, really awful little box character that I guess behaves like a regular mini Mario in a regular Mario versus DK game. But if you use a Mario character, then each of them has their own special powers. So Mario can wall jump. Luigi can jump higher. There's weird stuff also, kind of like Rosalina. I don't have that Amiibo, but I've looked at the video, and it looks like she's got special stages where she can use blue stars, like in Super Mario Galaxy, you know, where you touch them and she just gravitates towards them and then can jump from one blue star to the next. So that looks pretty cool. Yoshi can swallow enemies and stuff like that. So that's pretty nice.
Yeah, so I played the Yoshi kind of world that you get. So, you know, there's one where it's actually, you can play Yoshi on any level and he'll eat the enemies. But then there's the world that's like exclusive to him, which is
right. You take a little detour or something.
Yeah, and I assume that's where Rosalina gets all that sort of blue star stuff. And you know, with Yoshi, he's in these egg launchers, you know, which kind of fire him off in an egg, bouncing off walls and all this kind of stuff. They're pretty fun, you know. I mean, I had Mario versus DK 2 on DS back in 2007, and that was the last one of those I played, even though there's been, you know, quite a few since. I mean, I liked it. I've just never got around to playing any of the subsequent ones. But yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah,
more lemmings than the Amiga systems at this point.
Yeah, and like the egg launcher is a nice little thing to play with. You got to create new walls, use girders to create a wall to change the where Yoshi's going to land. And you've got, of course, like Yoshi's Island music in the background. And I really enjoy the presentation.
Those games always had really cool music. Mario vs. DK 2 had some really great remixes. And
yeah, like when you're waiting, when you're like the level select screen, you get this little like kind of jazzy little percussion thing, drums thing going on, and it's just really nice. And the graphics, like, very colorful, very like bold colors. I think it's cell shaded. I love it. So I do recommend, like, if you've got Amiibos, of course, download it and play it. Don't make the mistake of downloading Lost Reavers instead. But if you don't
But John, you've got a 30th anniversary Mario Amiibo, haven't you? So, I mean,
I try to
and every
about
other
that.
Amiibo last time I checked.
No way, man. No way. I'm one and done.
one complete collection and done.
Still in the package, though, I will say. Just for the record.
Well, yeah, of course. You wouldn't want to open them.
But yeah, I definitely wouldn't buy like a complete set of like 9 Mario figures to play this game, because it's, you know, like you get 4 Yoshi levels and that's it. You get 4 Mario specific levels and that's it. So it's a freebie, you know, quote unquote.
It's a nice bonus if you've already got it and you didn't necessarily expect, you know, that this was going to be something you'd get out of it. But other than that, I'm not seeing a kind of a nice sort of content to price ratio.
John will lend you his amiibos. Don't worry about it.
And I played it on Wii U. It looks great. But of course, if you've got a new 3DS, or I guess it must be compatible with the old 3DS if you've got the portal.
Yeah, and the portal.
The Hockey Puck, yeah.
Yeah, so you can use that too. It's on both systems.
And it's free. On both systems, it's free. But that is it for our new business segment. And when we return, we have a lot of email. I put out the call. And you crazy people answered. And you sure answered. So, after the break, it's time for your listener mail. It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. Oh God, really?
Yup, really.
Oh.
First up this week we have a preview of Metroid Prime Federation Force on 3DS.
Oh, well, come on, you say it loud and proud, man.
Neil and Zach had a chance to go hands-on with the next blockbuster in the Metroid Prime franchise at PAX East, and lived to write about it. I won't, though. Witness Neil lying to himself, saying that it might be good and might have voice chat. Witness Zach being the voice of reason, using phrases like, it looks like a DS game, and words like, underwhelming. Witness John quitting RFN and never buying a Nintendo system ever again. It might be for the best.
Yup.
Federation farce. We also have a preview of Tokyo Mirage Sessions Sharp FE on Wii U by Don Koopman. Don goes hands-on with this mashup of Shin Megami Tensei and Fire Emblem, and comes away impressed. If you're ignorant of what this game is all about, his in-depth thoughts on it will clue you in and might just put it on your wish list. Fans of the Japanese entertainment industry look like they're in for a treat.
The Japanese entertainment industry, James.
In quotes. I'm not sure what entertainment industry you're referring to.
I don't know. I just find the phrase Japanese entertainment industry very
amusing. It
sounds
slightly sinister.
Yeah, it's a little bit sketchy to me. Like, boy, I've never sat here and said, boy, I really want a game about the Japanese entertainment industry. But I really want
the Japanese entertainment industry. Yeah. I mean, a game about it. Sorry, excuse me.
Of course you would. All right, and we have a review of Twilight Princess Picross for the 3DS by Neil Ronahan.
You mean My Nintendo, The Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess?
I refused to write that entire title because it's absurd. Your me and Miitomo is simply a slave working to get you them fat My Nintendo rewards. Twilight Princess Picross, or whatever ridiculous name you decide to call it, is free, but what isn't free, James, is your time. So is it worth it? Neil breaks down what makes this better or worse than the other Picross games out there.
You know who else broke this down, John?
Who?
Guillaume, like 30 seconds before this audio starts.
We don't care about Guillaume, though.
Oh, God! I didn't say that.
At least not in
Jesus.
Now Play. Guillaume has
Guillaume
no place.
Is editing this, John! Did you miss that part? Guillaume has the power of life and death over us right
hey,
now.
Man. Hey. Look, I just call it like I see it, right? All right? I speak for the common man here, right?
Guillaume, please.
Guillaume has
please.
No place in Now Playing, all right? Let's just call it. All right, I'm moving on. Pray we also me. Have a review of Pocket Card Jockey for the 3DS by Neil Ronahan. Again, Neil. Way back when I was a kid, in between battles fighting off the Mongol hordes, I used to think, boy, I wish I had a solitaire horse racing video game to pass the time. Fast forward a couple of years, and that time has come. Neo calls Pocket Car Jockey nonsense of the highest degree, quote unquote. And I think we can all get behind that. By the way, yes, I know the Mongols invaded in the 50s. I'm not a history teacher.
You sure aren't, John. As we will find in the next segment, you can get all this and more history. I guess. I don't know. This one's gone off the rails pretty good. Right now, at AttenderWorldReport.com.
We love you, Guillaume.
Hey, we're back. It's time for listener mail. You can send us your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. So I put out a call for email related to the news of last week, and
Did anything happen while John and I were out?
Yeah, don't worry about some E3 stuff. It's fine. You know, I mean...
Good. I'm glad I didn't miss anything. Yeah, I'm glad I won't miss anything for the rest of the summer, as a matter of fact.
All right.
Till next March.
Heyo.
All right, we all know that you're super excited for Tokyo Mirage Sessions, John Lindemann.
Oh, you know it. It's right in my wheelhouse.
So, as you are excited, can you please read the first email?
Johnny Mo asks, with the Wii U all but dead for the next 12 months and Nintendo not giving us any news about NX, why not at least give their dedicated fans the security that any eShop purchases made on Wii U or 3DS will carry over to NX? With that little bit of info, loyal fans can go ape shit in the eShop until NX comes out. What the F, Nintendo?
I like that as an episode title, Ape Shit in the eShop, but I'm not sure I can use it.
That's good. Well, you know, I certainly hope, you know, we could get something in this kind of area, maybe. I mean, I don't know about any eShop purchases, but, you know, the virtual console stuff, you know, stuff that you would think might carry over in some fashion would be nice. I mean, it's interesting with the talk, the investor brief and stuff, and the Q&A, and what they were talking about, of course, that they did... slash, you know, the Wii U projections relative to where they were the year before.
Yes.
You know, to down to, was it like 800,000?
800,000 sales for the next fiscal
year. Yeah, instead of 2.4 million, which was already, you know, a pretty small amount for a year. But, you know, one of the things they said in terms of the expected kind of short, you know, the revenue drop off is that they were quite bullish about what they could do with digital revenues. And that's interesting because you think about the last fiscal year and you think about some of the real drivers of the growth that they had in downloadable revenues. You think about, the Pokemon. Re-releases of virtual console, you think about Smash DLC, Mario Kart DLC, you know, at least yeah. The second part of it, I think, snuck into to the last fiscal year. You know, what is going to compete with that in this period, do you think? I'm struggling to see anything quite as fearsome as all that kind of stuff. So,
Lost Reaver DLC.
If they're gonna, anything they could do to kind of you know, propel sales in the time being would seem helpful, but it's a real question of just how much of this stuff is actually gonna cross over. I mean, you've got the My Nintendo.
That's my worry.
You've got the My Nintendo infrastructure there, so it seems like there's a certain amount of things you could do. And I certainly believe that eventually, when NX gets here, it will be a case of you could have multiple devices, and you know, it would be an account system where it's on all your NX devices at the same time, you know, none of this system transfer kind of stuff that we've seen before. Yep. That's certainly what I expect and hope. But whether that kind of reaches back into this previous generation of devices, I'm not so sure. So I kind of agree with the sentiment, but I wouldn't bet my life on it, that's for sure.
Yeah, I would expect anything like that to be only on NX and forward, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, I have a concern, and we'll get to it in the follow-up email of this one, is that just for hardware, because the 3DS, the DS, the Wii U, the Wii, to some extent, are such kind of odd systems, like, that making them compatible with future hardware is going to be difficult. I mean, if let's say, for the sake of argument, whatever that Nintendo's next handheld is only has one screen, how would you port 3DS games to it? Like, how would you do that?
Yeah.
Consistently. Like, how could you say that every 3DS game will work on this thing? I mean, you can't. Maybe some will work just fine and they don't need a second screen. Maybe some will be just completely unplayable messes. And or if it doesn't have touchscreen? Like, how would you be sure that it would work if it doesn't have 3D? I mean, there's, well, granted, but like, there is, I think Nintendo is reticent to say it because they probably don't think it, they can do it. And they, to a certain extent, they probably can't.
Yeah.
Not for every game. For some games, sure. For virtual console games, for example, they I hope they can, but for some games, it just may not be viable.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think there's going to be a controller that's going to be able to accept 3DS games in some way, shape, or form.
I just
into their home.
I just don't think that they. I don't think that they would just like drop that entire. I mean, there's money to be made there, even with people buying 3DS games to use with something new. Like, I just don't think they would drop that completely because. I don't know.
Well, I think that Sony has shown that not only you can thrive not offering backwards compatibility, but you can also thrive by just upporting your franchises from the previous gen and just making people rebuy your games for that new system. And I'm kind of scared that maybe Nintendo, like, that's the page that Nintendo will take from Sony's book.
Yeah.
Life lessons from the Vita is what you're suggesting?
No, but well, from the PlayStation 4. I mean, the Vita had backwards compatibility. Did that help it that much? It doesn't seem like it moved a needle.
But remember, it only did if you had digital. If you had physical, like, your SOL.
Yeah, sure. But you look at other backwards compatibility, other backwards compatible systems like the Wii U, and did that move the needle a lot? It doesn't look like it did.
I don't think it ever does, really. I think people, it's something that people clamor for, but when they get it, they're like, yeah, I'll get, you know, a couple of games. Really, they don't use it very much.
It matters most during the opening of the console cycle.
Yeah, if you feel like getting some use out of it.
I think it matters more for, like, the situation that Johnny Mo sets up. Like, it matters more for the owners of the Wii U that are currently buying games. Like, I think that might give you confidence to buy more Wii U games. But sure. I don't think it's going to boost the sales of your next system. And that's what Nintendo wants to do, because Wii U sales right now, they're going to cap out whatever they release.
They're projecting that they're going to be poultry at this point. I mean, right. And they might not even manage that, don't forget, because they've pretty been consistently wrong with their projections.
I don't think he's projecting that they're going to sell more Wii U's for this. I think it's more to get money out of the
existing base.
It's that digital revenue stream, isn't it?
Yeah, and like I said,
to fleece the four of us specifically.
They are relying on that as well. They've said it to the investors, like, we're expected to get good money out of that. So, you know, I think it's not out of the question that there could be something that would be aimed at, you know, getting, you know, that could be aimed at getting people to say, oh, well, you know, these purchases are going to carry over and that. But of course, you know, as we're not going to hear about NX at E3, then presumably we're quite some way away from them committing to anything like that. We would, perhaps in the late summer or the autumn or whatever, when they finally start, you know, uncorking this stuff, we might learn. Maybe it'll be even later than that. Who could say?
Well, I'm going to read the next email, and this one ties back into the question about just hardware compatibility. Because John writes, "Hey RFN crew, I've been listening to yours and the rest of the internet speculation about the NX since it was announced, and I've heard the word hybrid in the mix plenty of times. The idea of a console handheld hybrid is appealing, but no one can seem to agree on how it would work. My sincere belief is that the NX is a portable device first and foremost. This belief is amplified by the March 2017 release window. The Wii U used technology that enabled an HD image to be transferred wirelessly to the gamepad at lower resolution. Nintendo spent money on that tech, and they'd sure love to reuse it. I imagine the NX is a handheld unit that uses technology in reverse, a portable device that can cast gameplay to a television. This also falls in line with Nintendo's streamlining development internally, as they only have one platform to support. Nintendo cannot win on a heads-on fight with the PS4, Xbox One, and PC market. Even if they succeed in attaining third-party support, gamers are entrenched in their own ecosystems. Here's to baseless speculation. Keep up the good work, and I'll keep listening."
That was a nice fan fiction he wrote there.
Well, I mean, I tend to go along with the idea that the portable component could well be, you know, should be the basis of it, because I think you have to consolidate what they've got first, which is, you know, 60 million 3DSs around the world. It's not what the DS did, not nearly, but it's a hell of a lot better than the way what Wii U's done. It's 20 million in Japan alone.
Yeah.
And I think that market, as when we talk about how Japan centric they are, I think they will be looking to consolidate that Japanese market position first. You know, I mean, it has completely trounced the Vita, yeah, I mean, all that kind of stuff.
Going to not have a handheld.
No, absolutely. No,
it's just not going to happen.
The fear is if you say we're going all in on our handheld, just damn the torpedoes, handheld away. You still have to deal with phone gaming. Like, you have to address it head on.
Yeah.
And saying we're going to put some games on phones isn't addressing it head on. Like, you have to say we're going to offer something that goes beyond what phone gaming is, and you have to make that proposition attractive to people who already own multi-hundred dollar phones.
Mm-hmm. And well, I mean, it's going to be Pokemon that does that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Pokemon Go on smartphones, but it's just not the real Pokemon.
It looks like butt.
It's not that real crap.
but you have to appeal to more than just the Pokemon. Like, the 3DS's appeal goes beyond the sales of any given Pokemon game. And you have to try to re-engage that audience, many of whom may have bought their 3DS's prior to having a smartphone capable of playing the kinds of games that are now on smartphones. Yeah,
it's quite a while ago now, so
how do you square that circle? And saying, well, they're successful in handhelds, that's the way to go, isn't necessarily the surefire thing that we call it is, because look at who's making handheld games right now. There's not a ton of developers making them partners.
It's Japan, and that's the thing. I do think they will look to at least consolidate the position.
But it's not even all of Japan anymore. I wouldn't say so,
but it is a viable marketplace, and you know, you've got to think about renewing that, and I think that will be kind of mission one for NX, is to kind of find a way to kind of renew that market insofar as it can be with the way that mobile's coming in. But I think this is where streamlining their development resources and everything into one platform is probably the way to go, because you could have a device or a platform, a family of devices, whatever you want to call it, that could both consolidate, their position in Japan as best they can, while also, maybe pushing the console angle a bit harder elsewhere. Because as you say, I mean, I think it's the portable gaming space is getting squeezed really badly, by mobile and all that. So you want to try, I think you're trying to sort of thread a needle of something that's got, the convenience of being able to play portably, but something that can upscale to the living room well, something that can facilitate local multiplayer in living rooms really well, all that kind of stuff, which is probably even more important in Western markets than it is in Japan.
But the challenge is, right now, if you're trying to find partners to make games for your system, like, the people who are still making games besides Square Enix and the companies like that are making home console games.
And that's the thing. Again, like I said, I think that's the benefit of having a single platform, is that you can catch more people into this net. People will play this game exclusively portably or something, and then in America and Europe they might play it in their living rooms, but you don't have to split it up the way you used to. I think that's the appeal.
It's a big ask.
That is the appeal of this idea. The question is, how do you make it work at a price point?
It's a big ask to let's make PS4 power in a thing you can carry in your purse.
Yeah, and how do you make that work in terms of the price point? You know, everyone's talking about Wii U being overpriced for what it is and all that. How are you going to get something that is competitive in the marketplace and yet achieves all these things that you want it to achieve? It's difficult. I mean, what John describes is maybe one way they could thread that needle. Potentially, there are others. There's been all this chat, the stuff about patents with modular kind of computing units somewhere else and all this. I mean, there's a bunch of different ways, I guess, that maybe they could do. But I think that is the approach that would make sense. And at this point, we are still just speculating about how they would achieve it, because we're still waiting for that info.
All right, John, you have the next email.
All right, Dan from Canada asks, hey guys, so we know that Zelda will be on NX on NX and Wii U, but there will be no NX at E3. What could the NX version offer that isn't offered on Wii U? Do you think it will be obvious when they show the game at E3? Also, do you think that now the gamepad will factor into the NX somehow? To me, it seems unlikely that the Wii U version would offer the map, gyro, etc. on the gamepad, and NX would skip that and go back to a standard controller. Love to hear your thoughts.
I think when we see Zelda on Wii U in about a month now, I think it will be very interesting for how we can intuit onto NX. Because if we see that the gamepad stuff is super useful and like deeply integrated and they've spent a lot of time on it, and with the conversations we've heard about like they're trying to figure out how to port games from the Wii U to NX, I think that starts to push the question of like, have they really given up on this double screen thing, or are they still bought in? If we see that Zelda on Wii U treats the second screen kind of as an afterthought, then you can start saying like, oh, did they maybe push all the second screen stuff aside when they realized it was an NX game also, or is this kind of just coincidence? And I don't think with Zelda on Wii U, anything will be a coincidence at this point.
Yeah, well, I can't see them using it as an afterthought. It would have to be integrated because, you know, typically those games are a showcase for the system. So,
but what system is it going to be showcasing? That's the question.
Well, I mean, Wii U, because that's what the design was originally made for, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I think so. If you go like, if you look at stuff like Wind Waker HD and Twilight Princess HD, you know, there's ways in which I feel like the gamepad brings quite a lot to the table in there, but you could still use a pro controller. So sure. I think there's still a scenario where it turns up at E3 and you're like, I don't know what this tells us about anything, because it's like, that's nice, but you don't really need it, you know, kind of thing. Like, it could be in that awkward little sort of medium kind of area.
I think if we see that it's doing the Wind Waker and Twilight Princess thing, I think that might actually speak more towards, oh, so maybe this thing doesn't have any kind of second screen. Because this is a very, you know, not even an organic growth. This is, we did this thing, we were going to do this thing exactly the same way, because there's no point in us spinning a lot of cycles on trying to improve on it, because this is the end. Mm-hmm. But if they come out there and, like, there's all kinds of weird integrations with the gamepad, I think they may have given away their hand a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be happy if you can just sit on your horse and honk your horn with the gamepad.
I would like to see the return from like Phantom Hourglass of like the ability to take notes on maps and stuff.
Yeah,
like,
that'd be
that
cool.
Was really...
Yeah.
And yeah, honk, having a big horn button would make a big difference.
I just don't think that we'll see anything as integrated as you saw in like Xenoblade Chronicles X, where like literally there's things in that game where you can't do it without the gamepad.
Yeah. And if Would it be totally shocking if there is stuff that gives away that the gamepad really matters and they don't show it because it would give away too much about the NX that this must be there?
Yeah, that's like, an interesting point.
Yeah, because that's the thing, right? The Zelda demos in the past traditionally at E3 have been like, okay, here's a boss, here's kind of part of a dungeon, or sometimes a full dungeon, usually the first one, which usually is not the one that goes deepest into the game's mechanics. And, some other third thing. I can't remember now.
But, yeah, Skyward Swords.
Maybe something more
was,
puzzly or. Yeah.
Skyward Swords was dungeon number two, one of the Zant fights, and one of the races on the bird.
Mm. Right. Yeah, so a mini game.
You mean Ghirahim?
Yeah. Ghirahim, sorry, not Zant. Yes.
Yeah, but the other thing that's kind of interesting is just that, you know, considering this Zelda is supposed to be more about the free roaming nature of it and all that, you know, it showing those little sort of slices doesn't really convey that, does it? So the whole thing, it seems like it might be a bit tricky to demo.
Well, good thing they have all day to show.
Yeah,
it.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, at least they've got a giant booth to do that, and the Treehouse Live that's going to be, you know, pretty extensive on it. So we'll see how good a job they do.
Guillaume, you have the next email.
Den from Canada returns with another email. Hi guys, I would like to know your thoughts on the potential impact on Nintendo, specifically in North America, as a result of future President Trump's coronation. Specifically, I thought this was a serious email at first. Specifically, I would like to an analysis of his trade policy, as well as if he requires a certain percentage of a good to be manufactured in America to make it great again. Is this, because America was so much better when America was making the NES.
It was.
Is this the real reason the NX was delayed to March, so as to build more time in for moving manufacturing of the NX to the States? Also, what does this mean for John? I imagine he will promptly be examined under President Trump's new registration law. Finally, do you think Trump will play Zelda on Wii U or the NX? Please give me a full analysis of this prospect of Donald Trump as president. Signed, a concerned neighbor.
With a U.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be able to look at this from kind of a distance, although there's not nearly enough distance.
I think first off, his first action will be to insist that all of those U's need to go away to continue any trade agreements, which is fair. They're superfluous.
Yeah, I mean, for myself, I'm already making ties to the Underground Railroad before he closes the borders.
That's a whole different thing, John! You are never going to pass your citizenship test at this rate.
I'll call it whatever I want, man.
I don't think there's much to be done with this email other than now the whole of the US is in the position that Bills fans were in a few years ago, except you don't have to worry about Bon Jovi becoming president as the other sort of possibility. So we've already been through this. You'll come out on the other side. It'll be okay.
The border's a disaster, Bill.
I like the idea, though, that to pontificate on will he play it on the Wii U or NX, and I think regardless of the answer is going to be huge.
It'll be huge.
Well, I would think that he would probably, I don't know, we haven't seen the NX controller, but with his small hands, he might have a problem gripping the gamepad. So I would think that if he plays it on Wii U, he would play it with a pro controller.
Yeah, rather than the
controller. That is the only thing about him that is small, John. Don't worry about it.
All the rest of him is huge.
To be fair, interesting thing is Trump does have an interesting retro kind of taste in isolating Japan as eating America's lunch, which is kind of weird given the 20 plus year of relative economic stagnation that country's been going through.
Yes.
So I don't know whether that would mean anything ominous for Nintendo in terms of any trade wars that he feels.
To give a semi-serious answer, probably rattling the Bank of Japan's cage about,
monetary
not having
policy,
their currency
yeah.
allowed to. But ultimately, the U.S. is doing that anyway.
And that is actually very important to Nintendo, the whole issue.
Oh, super important, yeah.
The currency, because they said in the investors' stuff just recently, we do not anticipate charging, pricing the NX a loss on the hardware, mainly because the currency situation is going to be better than it was back when the Wii U came out.
Because $104 yen to the dollar at this point. So it's back up to, it's not at historic highs because there was a situation a couple years ago where it was really bad. But from Japan's standpoint, it was great because, economic speaking, I get a lot of money back when I sell in the U.S., ultimately, in my home currency. So, from that standpoint, that the next president may push Japan because Japan was involved in sort of Abenomics-related, intentional currency deflation. And a lot of the developed world was doing that. To a certain degree, that was happening in Europe with the euro. That's why the euro and the dollar kind of have more parity than they have now. The U.S. dollar, for whatever reason, really wasn't falling into that trap. It was kind of holding steady-ish, but potentially just because everybody else was kind of falling relative. The Canadian dollar's run into this problem as well. That's why eShop games cost so damn much in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
That is a political football for all parties on the U.S. political spectrum because it does make manufacturing in the U.S. unviable. But to Guillaume's point, it's not as if the Super Nintendos, despite being specially built for North America, were actually built in North America. So it's kind of a moot issue. But no, once he is coronated president, it ultimately, I don't think it's going to happen.
That doesn't work. Right?
Yeah. I mean, more or less, that's the basic outline. Anyway, and then doubling back to the topic of what Nintendo could do to get our money out of the eShop, Leo writes, "Dear crazy, logical, laid-back, and overthinker, I'll let you figure out which is which. After the details we got about NX coming in March and needing to divert all of their resources to the development of games for NX, both of which I'm very happy with, and delaying Zelda U/NX to March, there are a lot of fans who aren't happy right now. I have some thoughts on things they, Nintendo, could do between now and Christmas to keep fans happy without using up their own development resources, and I'm wondering if you think they'll do even one of them." Included in his list are: pay outside studios to create remakes of GameCube games. Wind Waker HD took about 6 months to complete, and they used an outside developer to make it. They could do games like Sunshine, HD, Kirby Air Ride, Fire Emblem, Path of Radiance, F-Zero GX, Four Sword Adventure, Pokemon Snap, which isn't a GameCube game. But, and then he says maybe they could even be lucky and pull off like Rogue Leader HD.
Nope. A couple of things. First of all, Wind Waker was internal, right? And then it was Twilight Princess HD that was
right. Twilight Princess was that external, yeah.
Straight, right. The other thing is on the Rogue Squadron. My God, a Rogue Squadron game with Star Fox's new controls would have been amazing. It'll never happen. But the Adventures of Rey and Chewie and the Millennium Falcon or whatever with those controls co-op, it would have been great.
And the B-Wing is supposed to have a gunner in it, so that would make sense.
All the other vehicles, it could have been, that'd be spectacular.
They'll do it, but it'll all be like straight ahead corridor missions.
Exactly. I guess this is what they mean by poetic justice. That's a quite similar deal. It's just throwing it in there.
He also posits they could pay another studio to bring GameCube games to the Virtual Console, noting that he has a buddy who put Homebrew on his Wii U, and that it can do it. And yes, the Wii U can play Homebrew GameCube games natively. Smash, 1080 Avalanche, Army Men, Baten Kaitos, Beyond Good and Evil, Doshin the Giant, Eternal Darkness, The Twin Snakes, Beautiful Joe, and Wario World would be the games that he would like to see on there.
Yeah, obviously they got M2 to do the GBA on Wii U, didn't they? And that went very well. But GameCube, I would imagine, is a bit of a different thing. I'm not sure whether that's really in M2's wheelhouse the same way.
You'd probably have to just make the Wii U think they're Wii games, ultimately. And then it'd be more like the
Wii games that are already to buy. You know, they're not really sort of virtual console games. They could have just got some sort of wrapper on it in a way. But GameCube games are not necessarily that. I don't know whether it's just they see it as a rich vein of sort of revenue considering the modest sales of that system in the first place, although, you know, better than the Wii U's.
It's just too hard.
Yeah, is it worth doing relatively? But I suppose, again, it's another kind of thing that maybe it would be a new initiative like this, while it might seem odd at the end of a life cycle, would have, if we sort of pair this with the previous email we got, would make more sense if it was seen as kind of a lead-in to something on NX,
right?
Where it's like, well, you could buy it now and that purchase will carry over onto the next console too. Maybe then I think that's a kind of initiative that could work.
Yeah. He also posits they could pay another studio to bring GBA games to the new 3DS, sort of like what you talked about with the Wii U.
That's definitely something M2 could do, I would have thought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they could pay EA and 2K to bring Madden, FIFA, and NBA to Wii U. He says because those three games already have versions on Wii U, they just update them with the new rosters and features. That seems like a bigger ask because there's nothing running the current engine of those games on a comparable system.
Well, I suppose they could. They probably would have to pay them. They would have to pay EA to do that, and it's not worthwhile for them to do that. So, that's not happening.
I mean, bear in mind, we're looking at, based on his email here, we're looking at a time frame of like 6 months. So, none of this stuff could happen in 6 months.
Not unless it was already in the works.
Yep. Yeah.
He says, get Ubisoft to do DLC for Rayman Legends, which would be interesting. I'm a little surprised they didn't, to be honest. Like, I'm kind of surprised they didn't just do that to begin with. Yeah, I mean, Ubisoft does DLC pretty heavily. I'm surprised they didn't do something.
Yeah, but the game, if the game itself doesn't sell enough, it's just not worth
it. They didn't see
it. But see, the implication is that DLCs is in Ubisoft land is planned well before the game even comes out. And
I'm saying is they didn't project very good sales.
At a certain point they didn't. I think that's clear because the whole move to the other systems at a certain point they kind of felt like, yeah, we better try and spread this as much as we can because this isn't going to go that great. But basically, it seemed like they had modest expectations at that point.
He suggests a physical release of Fatal Frame, which...
That could happen.
Sure.
I mean, I don't think they're going to do it, but they could do it.
You could do that in 6 months. They could hand Pride Giant Robot to another dev and get it finished, even just as a $10 eShop game like Star Fox Guard, or make it Nintendo Land DLC. It probably will be its own eShop game, to be honest.
Yeah, they kind of. Miyamoto's made comments about basically that's, kind of shelved, at least for the time being. So, I can't imagine that's going to come back in the time frame like John's talking about. But they do like to return to stuff eventually.
I've played it. There is definitely something there.
No, and I would say, look at Steel Diver. That was a DS demo.
Oh my God.
An early DS demo. And it came back years later. This is the sort of thing Nintendo does not just forget this stuff. So I think it's pretty, take Miyamoto at his word when he says it's kind of something they were experimenting with. They didn't quite get to a point where they found a package that they could release it in, but it could come back, definitely. But just not in this time frame.
Yeah, I think the most reasonable a reprint of Wii U games that we might have missed, like Lego City Undercover for $20 each.
Yeah, they did that in Europe already. Lego City Undercover is part of the Nintendo Selects over here. Which is on the eShop now for £20, not $20. So there is a significant difference there.
Yes.
That's the topic of exchange rates. That is a cool thing because that's never really a game that dropped much in price physically. I guess they did a limited run of it over here or something like that. Is something I was interested in. I've always had something of an interest in it, but the fact is that, I didn't feel like I was going to pay, top whack for it, and it never dropped. But now we have the sort of, this situation where you've got a reprint of it physically. And you've got then an accompanyingly sort of lower eShop price as well. So I've got two sort of avenues to pursue. Believe it or not, there are games that I've missed on Wii U. For all the jokes about how few there are or whatever, I've not played everything on it. And I've still got plenty to go.
Funky Barn is coming up.
Nintendo Selects Funky
Barn. That would be the best. From the makers of Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess HD. They could release all Wii games on the Wii U as a download, noting Xenoblade was released yesterday at the time of email. That would be hard, but they could certainly do a hell of a lot more of them than they have.
Yep. True. Yeah, absolutely.
And that would be great if they did two of those a month through the end of the year. Like, especially if they weren't games everybody bought.
I'll be honest, the Fire Emblem one baffles me they haven't done that because it is sought after. I can't remember which Radiance that is. It's one of the Radiance games, forgive me.
Radiant Dawn.
Radiant Dawn, right. So that is very sought after because there weren't that many physical copies. But also just the Fire Emblem boom that we're going through. It seems like one of the obvious things. They've re-released DS games and GBA games on the Virtual Console. It would seem like the Wii would be a natural choice, and perhaps it will happen not long from now, you're absolutely right, James. They could be doing a fair bit more because obviously there were many, many. I can't imagine necessarily going to get a huge tranche of the third party stuff. They've done some, like Resident Evil 4 Wii Edition, for instance, Zack and Wiki, that kind of stuff. But just the first party stuff, there's some low hanging fruit there.
But I would imagine if Nintendo approached some of the partners they're still working with, or the ones they're going to be working with on NX, and said, look.
Yeah.
Here's the revenue split. We'll handle making sure it works. can we do it? Like, I imagine a lot of them would say, yeah, free money, let's do this. Like, at least some degree of them would say, like, yeah, we'll take that run. I mean, they're still tight with Capcom. I can imagine they could work out a deal there. And they already have for some games. But, you know, I can't get Sengoku Basara on my Wii U, and that's a shame. Because that's a game that everyone needs to play and go, what the fuck am I doing with my life?
Well, I think that a lot of people had that experience with the Zelda Musou game.
Yeah, I mean, I had it with Epic Dumpster Bear, just for the record.
I tell you, I'm just saying, Sengoku Basara might not be as that out there anymore.
It's never gonna happen, but
no, it's
never
it's
gonna happen. But I would love Zangeki no Rekinlev to get a surprise return, even if it's mostly untranslated.
That would be awesome.
The Wii Motion Plus, like we have the Wii Remote Plus now, so you don't have the ugly snap-on thing. You know, you could play it the way it was intended. I've always wanted that. And I have a Japanese Wii. You know, I've got everything I could need to play it, but it is quite expensive. Although in Japan, they did put it on the digital service. So if I had a Japanese Wii U, I could download it, but that sure as shit isn't happening because it's, apart from the virtual console stuff, there's not a lot of Japan exclusive Wii U content. That's for sure.
No.
And that would actually be probably a pretty good angle, like the Japanese Wii games that never came out here too. They could do those. Like there are options. Like to me, this is the one that screams like, Nintendo, what the hell, do this. This seems like a win. Like even if they don't make a ton of money on these, it's still good PR. It's still good mindshare. Like if they announce like, hey, here's four games coming to Wii U in the next month, like one a week, and all of them are ridiculous for some reason or another. Like
I wouldn't be surprised if you see a few things that not necessarily these in particular, but a few things you wouldn't otherwise have expected, simply because, as I said before, they depending on driving up digital sales to some extent, and the fact that it seems obvious that there really isn't going to be very much there. In the Christmas period, there just isn't. You know, it's getting moved to NX. You know, all this is Zelda. Obviously, is the big headliner, but there's probably games we don't know about that have already been quietly moved. I would argue that probably a new Animal Crossing is one of those games, for instance, that's already been. You know, that's why Amiibo Festival was sent out in its place because they didn't want to waste it on Wii U at this point. You know, so I think if you've taken that as given. There is going to be this hole there that, yeah, I don't think you can work miracles, but Nintendo fans will be ready at that time of year to spend money on Nintendo stuff. So you may as well find something to put out there. And, you know, old games is probably going to be the best way to do it. And hopefully just be something that's a little bit out of the really, really obvious zone. Like I said, I mean, they've done Trauma Center. That should be applauded. I'm sure there's other opportunities to do that sort of thing. And potentially maybe one sort of remake type of deal that could have been hastily commissioned when they felt like they were already on this path, perhaps, as well.
Well, and you can charge so much more for a Wii U game, or for a Wii game, than you can for, like, more NES virtual console games. Like, just from a sheer, like, money standpoint, it's going to make a bigger splash.
Yeah, and especially if you give a rebate to people who have already bought it on a Wii. Like, they're only making, what, $1, $1.50 for SNES games? Or $2?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, there's not a whole lot of margin there.
Seeing the virtual console come back to life would be a big one. But lastly, he suggests that they hire the makers of Guacamelee to do a 2D Metroid for the 3DS. Okay, first off, that's never happening between now and the holidays. And secondly, what is 2D Metroid?
Yeah, that's never happening, period.
Oh, I thought that James was asking, what is 2D Metroid? Is it Zero Mission? Is it Fusion? There's like these different philosophy of design here, you know? Yeah, the first NES Metroid, like, are we trying to go back to that the spirit of that game? Where
Other
no
end.
Map, and it's just you and an ice beam, and then you switch.
The thing I would point out here is that 3DS is not going to be
product,
as 3DS is not going to be as gloomy that it would need something like that. You'd be talking about Pokemon Sun and Moon is obviously going to be very big. I think there's going to be a certain amount of other games maybe that haven't even been announced yet that will come along for 3DS. 3DS is not going to be as dead as Wii U is at the end of this year, because there's just so many more systems out there. I know the software sales, particularly in the West, have not been particular. They've been softening a bit, but you still do have some success stories like the Fire Emblem, which hasn't even come out in Europe yet. There's still more money to get out of that. I don't think it's going to be this barren wasteland. I mean, you know, there's a lot of parallels here between what happened in Christmas 2005. You know, where, of course, that was meant to be Twilight Princess, and it didn't happen.
Right.
It got moved to the Wii and the GameCube. Wouldn't come out for a full year later. Personally, I think Nintendo will stick to March because of the fiscal year thing. I think that is a pretty hard constraint that they will not... I wouldn't bet my life on this, but I think it's a pretty hard constraint. They do not want to go back on that. I mean, it's like Miitomo, you know, like, when did that come out? Like, the last day of the fiscal year or something?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, they took it all the way to the wire, but they said that first mobile app was going to come out worldwide, you know, in that time frame, and ultimately it did. Like, I think that is a pretty tough constraint they will stick to. But, you know, you go back to Christmas 2005, what did GameCube have? Super Mario Strikers, Mario Party 7. It was pretty barren.
It was bad.
The difference is DS was in its ascendancy, vibrant.
Right.
There was where the games were falling out of the sky all over the system. You know, Dawn of Sorrow, Advance Wars, all this stuff coming at once. It was really taking off. It was great. 3DS is not that vibrant. You know, at this point, and of course, you know, the whole RPG gags, like, yeah, there's quite a lot of good games, but they kind of skew in one direction a lot. But it's still, I think 3DS will be less, much, much, much less sobering than Wii U.
It's got one good holiday left in it.
Yeah, I think
Wii U has none.
I mean, some of the stuff that we already know about. I mean, we talked about Picross 3D 2. I'm really looking forward to that, even if it's a niche thing. Kirby, I'm really pumped for that because I enjoyed the last 3DS Kirby. Rhythm Heaven's coming to the West, which I've already played, but everybody else has got that to look forward to. Then you've got the RPG stuff, Dragon Quest, Pokemon. I mean, there's stuff there. I don't think it's as vibrant as DS 2005, but it's not that bad. So, we need to talk about hastily commissioned 2D Metroids for 3DS. I wouldn't say no, believe me, I wouldn't, but I don't think it's that dire on 3DS that we need to talk about far-flung scenarios like that.
Fair enough. Well, speaking of Castlevania, because you did mention one in there.
I did.
We have our retroactive, although I talked about it last week. It is Castlevania Rondo of Blood. It is our next retroactive topic. The thread is open to talk about it. You can go talk about it there. There'll be a link in the show notes as well. I still haven't locked down with these guys when we're going to play it. It will be pre-E3. It may be the week before E3.
What about that big E3 preview episode that we've got to plan out? You know, we've got to
it's about,
work
it's about
that now.
I had a spreadsheet for what I was going to do during E3 since I wasn't going to be able to go and how RFN was going to handle it. I have deleted that spreadsheet. It is no longer relevant. So, I think we'll have time. Hell, maybe we'll do the retroactive during E3. I don't know.
I mean, we're coming up on the summer of no games. Actually, we're coming up the summer and winter and spring of new games. Boy, oh boy.
Well, I can't remember what it was being called now. Too hot for games?
It doesn't work as an auditory thing because you can't see the two hot for games.
It's the Roman numeral two, thank you.
Really? So I didn't know Roman numeral.
Keeps it classy.
So
a year of no games.
There will be some stuff from RFN, but the first thing on our list of stuff from RFN is our retroactive Rondo of Blood. So go save your little girl who uses cats and magic. And get to Killing Dracula, because we will be talking about it soon. Again, that was listener mail. You can email us at rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and that is going to do it for the show this week. Greg, help us out of our gloom with some music.
Yeah, I've been saving this particular music suggestion for a rainy day, and I think that day has come.
It's pouring.
The tone of some of those emails, so cheer yourself up, and I don't know what nightmare parallel world we're in when I have to say that. cheer yourself up with this beautiful song from Secret of Mana back on the Super NES called The Color of the Summer Sky.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.